All right, you know I like you, Mark, but this is a candidate interview, so buckle up, Buttercup.
Let's go.
Okay, you ready? Mark Mullett, welcome back as a candidate for governor. Last time we had you here, I had this throwaway question at the end. Like, oh, have you ever considered running? And little did I know, you were considering it.
I know. You've got a good track record of catching me off guard with questions when I'm on your show.
Let's see if I can do that today. How long were you considering that bid?
Well, I think what I saw after the Tiffany Smiley race, I think Bob Ferguson started to view this as a coronation, where he realized that Republicans were having a hard chance after the Dobbs decision on Roe v. Wade of challenging on a statewide level. And to me, it was really frustrating that he was viewing this as a coronation. And I just don't think our voters wanted to see a coronation. I think they wanted to see a choice. And I'm in this race to clearly provide a choice. It's a choice on public safety, and it's a choice on affordability. And I think I give people that choice by being in the race that they're not getting if, you know, Bob Ferguson ends up being a fourth term of Jay Inslee.
Yeah, he obviously has some concerns about you, because where'd this go? Oh, here it is. He the night before you announced, he released an attack ad on YouTube, and it is reflected in his flyer that he sent out as well. It's the same sentiment, basically suggesting that you're not a Democrat. He said, now we have a new challenge. Another Democratic candidate, State Senator Mark Mullett, just entered the race. You decide if he's your kind of Democrat. They reference an interview we did in 2022 when I was asked whether you'd support Biden for president in 2024. You said, I think it would depend on who the Republican candidate was. And they talk about a vote against protecting reproductive health data, opposing the $15 an hour minimum wage, blah, blah, blah. So for you, is that a surprise that so quickly Bob Ferguson would come out and try to frame you as not a Democrat?
Well, I think Bob's doing the same math we started doing a few months ago, which is, yeah, I think his calculation is correct. I think he beats pro-life Republicans by double digits in this election, but he's realizing that if I get out of the primary, I will beat him. And that's the mathematical reality. If I get out of the primary, I will beat Bob Ferguson because I'm giving voters the things they want to see the Democratic Party do better on, which is better on public safety, better on taxes, better on business regulations, but holding strong to the social values of why a lot of people tend to vote Democrat. But I have an 11-year voting record on those social values. He can attack them all he wants. Like the bill he referenced there was a boondoggle for the trial lawyers. It wasn't about women's reproductive health care privacy. It was a trial lawyer giveaway bill. And I made it clear I will support the legislation, but not when you amended it in the Senate to make it a trial lawyer boondoggle. And I think I'm happy to have these public policy debates as we move forward in the campaign. And my track record on supporting women's reproductive rights is 100%. So I think it's going to be fun to have this debate with him.
Well, you said if you get out of the primary, you'll beat him. I agree with that sentiment. However, I think that just got more difficult. As you know, Dave Ryker just entered the race as a Republican. I have said on the show, which I know you watch the show every day, so you already know probably what I said about this, that I think the second Dave Ryker entered, it became a two-person race between him and Bob Ferguson. How do you even begin to hope to get out of the primary when Republicans are consolidating behind Dave Ryker?
Well, and I think, first off, filing week is in May of 24, so you're a long ways away. So when you say they're consolidating, that clearly has not happened yet. So I think we'll see as time goes forward whether that consolidation occurs. But to me, like when you go back to when I entered the race, there was unique things I was bringing. First off, I'm still the only small business owner in the race. And I think to get the change in government we need in Washington, we need a small business owner mentality in the governor's mansion. I think in terms of public safety, I appreciated, you know, Dave Ryker and I overlapped my first years in the Senate. He was still representing East King County in Congress. I have a lot of respect for Dave Ryker. I think he's a very nice human being. And on public safety, he actually endorsed me in my 2020 Senate race because he knows I didn't get caught up in this Democratic defund the police nonsense. I was strong on public safety, and that's why I have all the endorsements from the law enforcement groups out of the gate. I have them still, even with Dave Ryker in the race. They're still saying, hey, Mark Mullett has been our champion on public safety. We're supporting him with our endorsements. And to me, the key is if you want to make progress on affordability, which means being more acknowledging that our taxes, especially this long-term care payroll tax, has gone overboard.
We'll get into that.
If you want to do better on public safety, you have to have somebody you can actually win. You have to be electable. And when you look at historically in our state for the last two decades, there hasn't been any pro-life candidates who've won statewide. None. The Republicans who did win statewide were actually pro-choice Republicans, not pro-life Republicans. So if you go back to Kim Wyman, Rob McKenna, Sam Reed. And so my point is, if you want to see progress on affordability, you want to see progress on public safety, you have to find a candidate who is electable. And that's my point. And I think when we get to the primary next summer, that's going to play in voters' minds. Yes. They want to see somebody who can actually win the governor's race and make progress on those issues.
So you think, even though there's excitement around Dave Reichert, he's been sort of the unicorn Republicans have hoped to get, he's won in King County, he has name recognition, you think it'll be the same old thing, Republican and Democrat, and he would lose?
Oh, my God. In the general election?
In a general election. You think there's no chance?
There is no chance. I mean, anyone who thinks... And when you look at the fact that we haven't had a pro-life Republican for the last two decades, that was before Roe v. Wade got overturned. And you don't have to do any polling. You just have to look at the elections in the 22 cycle. We saw, once it got overturned, we saw this huge swing in our state in every race. And these are legislative races. They were statewide races where it became very obvious that, yeah, Washington voters care about this issue. And that is what makes me electable in the general election. I think it's really important for everyone to factor that issue in.
Even though Bob Ferguson's already trying to paint you as a hint of anti-choice.
And that shows he's doing that to somebody who has an 11-year track record, 100% supporting women's reproductive rights, and he's still making stuff up, trying to, you know, confuse voters about where Mark Mullett is on this issue. So that shows, I think, how important this issue is. And we learned that in the 22 election cycle. This isn't something we have to poll on now to see what people are thinking. We saw the results from Washington voters last year.
So, and again, this is your interview as a candidate for governor. I'm not going to sit here and dwell on Dave Reichert. We'll have him in. We'll talk to him about his candidacy and his chances. But you said to me previously that you are really counting on a robust Republican field to make it through. And I think mathematically that makes sense, right? So we know that Raul Garcia is dropping out. He's going to support Dave Reichert. If there isn't some sort of rush from other no-name Republicans to get into the race ahead of the filing deadline next year, I mean, realistically, you realize that you could not make it through.
I think it will depend. I think you're going to see multiple Republicans on the ballot.
Who are just like, screw you, Dave Reichert. I mean, I think you'll see Sammy Byrd.
And I think they have very different opinions. I mean,
you think two is enough to split it?
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
Two, if you have kind of this pro-Trump base who feels really strongly that Reichert doesn't represent their values, like, mm-hmm. and you get that. And then you're going to still have, I think, a lot of primary voters that are saying, hey, I want to vote for somebody in the primary who can actually win the general election. And I think that is always going to be important when we get to next August.
You, and I've already seen it from you, you're trying to keep one foot in the Democratic side, you know, keep those people happy. And then also you need to appeal to Republican voters. How do you strike that balance? Because like in this state, anything right is wrong, you know? And so how do you keep a hold of a base of Democratic voters while also convincing Republicans, hey, I'm your guy too?
Well, I think it goes to my voting record, 11 years. I have not been a windsock. There's no like I shift one way or the other based on what the polls say. Like I've been super consistent.
I agree.
So 100% support of women's reproductive rights, support of the LGBT community, and that's been consistent, and I acknowledge climate change is real. I've supported the gun responsibility bill, so we know that upsets people sometimes on the Republican side. But I have been super vocal in challenging my Democratic colleagues and saying, we have to do better on public safety. We have to do better on taxes. And if we don't look at business regulations, specifically around how hard it is to get a damn building permit in our state, it will not be affordable for families for their kids to be able to stay and raise their own families here. And I think the places where I challenge my fellow Senate Democrats to do better is where the general public wants to see us do better. And that's, so when I talk to Democratic voters, yes, they can be further left than I am on the political spectrum, but they're frustrated with public safety. They're like, the status quo doesn't work. And so when they realize there is a candidate who agrees with them on these social values, but is actually challenging our party to do better. And I think when the first deduction of the long-term care payroll tax comes out of people's paychecks in the next week here, they're going to be pissed. And I have a unique position of reminding our voters. I was one of two Democrats who said way back in 2019, even though I knew it was coming with a lot of political misery for myself, which I got in my 2020 race and survived by 58 votes, But I knew my vocal opposition to that bill in 2019 was because it was only good for a special interest group, not good for the overall state of Washington. So I'm challenging the Democrats to do better in the places where we should be doing better. And I think at the end of the day, when it comes time for the primary election, that's how you get the votes.
Yeah. So let's talk about public safety. You were instrumental in pulling the pursuit bill from certain death to the floor of the Senate, which I applaud you for doing. The pursuit bill did not turn out how anyone wanted, but I would argue it's better than nothing. But you were, again, you know, vilified by your own party for doing that. And so when it comes to the ability to really make a difference on those key issues, if you're a Democrat in the governor's office and you've got a Democrat Senate, a Democrat House, and they push through one of those crazy public safety bills that they say is about, you know, equity and police accountability to your desk, are you really going to have the political willpower to veto a bill that was sent to you by chambers controlled by your own party?
Oh my gosh, look at my voting record. Like, I stood up on, you know, the long-term care payroll tax. I stood up when you look at this police pursuit bill in the 22 session, there was a procedural vote to give that bill an up or down vote on the floor of the Senate. Mm-hmm. It was 21 Republicans plus Mark Mullett who stood up and yeah. said, this bill deserves an up or down vote. And so I have a proven track record of standing up to my party in the most difficult of political circumstances if I know it's what the general public wants to see. Like, to me, it's like you don't go to these special interest groups that are funding Democratic campaigns. You say, what does the general population in the state of Washington want to see from their government? They want to see improvements on public safety, not things that send us in the opposite direction. Any bill we pass that makes it harder to recruit police officers is not solving our public safety challenges in this state. And that's why I think I 100% am comfortable vetoing bills that move us backwards when it comes to public safety. I'm not going to allow it to happen.
So in 2021, had it been Governor Mullett and that bill that reduced the police ability to pursue came to your desk, you're saying you would have vetoed it?
I mean, at that time, it was interesting, right? Because we didn't realize the unintended consequences that were coming with that bill.
I did.
And, hey, that's to your credit.
A lot of people did.
And I think this is the ultimate challenge for any elected official. I think it's a challenge for any human being is to admit when you screwed up. And to me, that was what I realized in the summer of 21 is we screwed that issue up. Like, there was a lot of jurisdictions who had very restrictive police pursuit policies, but the criminals didn't know about it. Nobody was driving away from them when they got pulled over. It wasn't until we passed a bill that was on the front page of the paper saying, hey, we're not pursuing criminals who drive away, that we created our own misery with the fact that it was very public knowledge that that law had changed on a statewide level. And that, to me, was why I broke from my party in that 22 vote, saying this has to be fixed right now. This cannot wait any longer. It needs an up or down vote. And so, but yes, going forward, if you had bills that we're going to make it harder to recruit police officers because we're attacking them rather than supporting them. Yeah, that's not how we're going to make our state safer, and we're going to move it in the right direction.
And I do give you credit, because I know not everyone watching watches every minute of floor speeches, but when you pulled that pursuit bill off and put it on the floor, you did say those words. I was wrong. You know, I made a mistake, and I think we need to go back and fix it. So I give you credit for that, because I don't think a lot of politicians are willing to admit that publicly. Let's just do a little, would Mark veto this session, shall we? The capital gains tax, I'm imagining, veto.
I did not support the capital gains tax. I said, if we're going to make our tax system more progressive, you don't just create new taxes. You create one tax to lower a different tax. And that's where that bill just once again completely falls apart. Like, we didn't lower property taxes by putting in a capital gains tax. If we had said everyone's property tax bill is going to have a discount now, saying, hey, this is what capital gains generated, we're using that money to lower your property taxes. To me, that's a public policy conversation. Mm-hmm. But to say we're making our state tax system more progressive just by creating new taxes when we're not lowering other taxes is not actually helping. So yeah, if we want to rebalance the tax code, it's got to be done in a way where one tax is going up and we're promising that another tax is going down. And it can't be done in a way where you can show up 2 years later and undo the one that went down. Because that's what we saw in property taxes from education, right? We lowered local property taxes. And then the very first chance that came up, that lowering of local property taxes was increased. And I didn't support that. And you know, those are the challenges I have sometimes.
So that, as passed capital gains, Governor Mark Mullett would have vetoed it.
Yes. Didn't lower any taxes at all.
So if there is a future proposal for an income tax, that veto. Does not have offsets. Veto.
Veto.
At the same time, you supported the second iteration of the carbon tax, correct? After opposing it in 2018, right? I think it was 2018, which ticked Jay Inslee off. And then in 2021, you voted in favor of it. That has increased prices at the pump, I would argue, and a lot of people would argue, in a substantial way for working class families in our state. How do you defend that vote?
So I don't think there's anyone that's more frustrated with the increase the gas pump. You know, four of my six kids drive now. I don't give my kids a penny for gas. Like, they want money for gas, they got to work shifts at either Ben and Jerry's or my pizza restaurant. But the reality is, like, I get how painful the gas price increase. This gas price increase is very avoidable. This is Jay Inslee's administration doing it in a way that is not making fighting climate change affordable for Washington families. I actually dropped a bill in the middle of a session saying our carbon, you know, what we do in terms of our carbon auctions has to line up with what's happening in California. And at the time the bill was passed, that was the goal. Now we're going off at 2x of what California is. When you're 2x of California, you know you have a problem. So that's where I've been very vocal now, speaking up. When that bill passed, I think you're right. I knew it was a 10 to 20 cent gas price increase at the pump. Jay Inslee now is having a 40 to 50 cent gas price increase based on how they're implementing the bill. And this is where I think I'm different than other Democrats. I'm not saying, oh, this is all the fault of the oil companies. I'm intellectually honest. We knew when we passed that bill, we were going to raise the price of gas by 10 to 20 cents. But what I didn't sign up for is what's happening now, which is these runaway increases to try to, I guess, force people out of their cars. I don't know what the end goal is, but I'm not on board with it. I'm being very vocal in saying, as governor, I will use my authority to make sure our auctions are lining up with California, not a penny higher. And I promise to do that.
10 to 20 cents a gallon is still a lot, though.
I agree.
And you did that. You did that knowingly. And what do you think the net benefit is? Do you really think the net benefit of what we're doing with the carbon tax and the increase in costs to consumers at the pump and at the grocery store is worth it for the environment?
I think that the original bill, I think climate change is very real. You have to have some ways you're going to attempt to fight that. That initial bill as it passed with the 10 to 20 cents, that money was primarily directed into transit investments to say, hey, transit investments gives a way to relieve traffic congestion because people are getting out of their cars and into transit. At the same time, when that happens, you do have lower carbon emissions. So that first tranche of the bill, the money was really focused on infrastructure and the transportation space that wasn't just building new lanes. That, to be honest, freed up our capital, our transportation budget to invest in adding new lanes. So we're adding new lanes like on Highway 18. We're seeing those lanes on 405 go in right now. So the answer is always twofold in transportation is you need better transit. You also need to have money to actually add physical lanes to relieve congestion. I think that the Climate Commitment Act did enable us to do both because it gave money that we can invest in transit, which then freed up the money in the transportation package in 22 to focus on adding lane capacity.
Yeah, and for the record, just to solidify what you just said, Governor Jay Inslee, the Department of Ecology, your fellow Democrats in the Senate and the House, they continue to claim that their carbon tax, the fee, is not responsible for the 45, 46 cent per gallon increase that we're seeing at the pump. You say that's a lie.
I say that's a lie.
Why are they doing it then?
I think people just, you have to be intellectually honest with yourself in this job. And if you take an inelastic product, like oil is an inelastic product, and you add fees to that, it is going to be passed on to the end consumer. And so to me, that's why it's so important to make sure that as you move forward in the bill, and this goes to a lot of things, but you have to fight climate change in a way that makes it more affordable for Washington families. And Jay Inslee is dropping the ball on that front. He's doing it in a way that's not affordable for Washington families. And I'm very vocal in saying we can do a lot better.
And I just want to also, because this is a complicated issue. I mean, even for me, you know, the auctions process and all of that. So the reason California has a carbon tax, we have one. But the reason ours is higher is because their auctions go off at a lower price.
And yes. They're
capped, right?
Exactly.
For the carbon credits.
Yes.
So what do you want ours capped at? Exactly what California's is capped at?
That's what I think makes the most sense. Okay. We're trying to link to their system. And so to me, to make our auctions line up with California is like a no-brainer. And so the bill I dropped in session said it had to be within 20% of the most recent California auction. And so if their auction at the time was $28, like our last auction was at $56. So, you know, I don't know how exactly you do it, but to me, you want to have auctions lining up with California, not coming in at 2X. 2X of California. I mean, you know, if this isn't a wake-up call that we've gone too far, like being double of California when it comes to a tax or regulation should be telling all of us, hey, we're not doing this right.
Yeah. What can you do? I mean, even if you're governor, right, and you want that, Democrats.
So this is the beauty, I mean, right, gave authority to Jay Inslee and Department of Ecology to cap those auctions.
Oh, so they can't. You can do it on your own as the governor.
Oh, my gosh. You don't need a bill. Okay. And so I went to Department of Ecology the very first week of session back in January, and I said, I am freaked out about where auctions are going to go off because I'm not seeing any public messaging saying we're going to line up our prices with California. And they told me I was worried about something I didn't need to be worried about. And so I was like, well, are you sure? And they're like, yeah, trust us. Well, then the auction went off and I immediately dropped the bill because I was like, clearly my anxiety was well placed because our first auction went off at $48, not in the 20s. And so right out of the gate, it was very clear that we weren't doing everything we could to actually line up with California's auction prices.
Well, how stupid to pass a bill that leaves it at the whim of a governor and the Department of Ecology. Well, what was the point in doing that for lawmakers to say, because that seems like a very critical aspect of a bill to implement that program is to say, oh, let's line it up with California so it doesn't get out of control. So why did they feel the need to leave that out?
Well, I think there was, you know, as we heard from the governor, it's going to be pennies increase.
Pennies.
And so I think there was a lot of messaging there saying this isn't going to have a big impact. And so to me, I think if you had done all the work going into that bill after it was passed 2 years ago, back in 2021, saying, hey, we're lining up with California's pricing. That's our goal here. We're not going to be higher than them. We're not trying to, you know, force people out of their cars by having the highest gas prices in the entire country. We're going to make sure this lines up with California. I think you would have seen a very different result from that first auction.
Yeah. So a couple things that I've mentioned to you before, but I was talking to you about it in terms of you running for your Senate seat again before I knew that you were going to run for governor. Two things that I think are going to make it very difficult for you to convince Republicans to vote for you are your decision to vote in favor of the ban on so-called assault weapons.
Yep.
And your decision to support Senate Bill 5599, which I believe is an erosion of parental rights. So let's talk about both of those things. On the assault weapon ban, if you're trying to message to voters that, hey, I can win, Dave Ryker cannot win, history has shown us this, so vote for me pre-primary so that Bob Ferguson doesn't get through. And you've got some 2A people, which a lot of Republicans, that's an important issue to them. And they're like, not a chance in hell, Mark, not a chance in hell. How do you try to convince them that that one vote should not derail their support of someone who could beat Bob?
Well, and I think they have to look at the overall result. Like, I think first off on that issue, you know, my wife, Kelly, she teaches second grade in the Issaquah School District. I will say when there are the school shootings, like, teachers come home from schools, they're traumatized. I mean, it's a rough experience every time they happen. It has a real impact, I think, of what happens in the schools and how people feel. So I think the fact that we did something, I don't think is a bad thing. I think we had to try to do, and I know your argument is maybe we didn't do it the best way or we, you
well,
know,
my argument is it's unconstitutional.
And so I hear that. I think at the end of the day on that issue, I mean, I can't pretend to be somebody I'm not. Like, that's the thing. Like, they know, I think, the Republicans have worked with me in the Senate for the last 11 years and the people in my district who voted for me, they know that where I really stand up is kind of the small business perspective of saying, hey, we got to do better on taxes. We have to do better on regulations. And if we can't get public safety right, like, nothing in the state actually works. Like, those are the areas where I've been very vocal and challenging Democrats to do better. And so if people expect me to change after they vote for me as governor, that's not a realistic expectation. I'm not a political windsock. I will still support things that I think are common sense gun responsibility measures.
Yeah, I don't expect you to make excuses just because you're sitting here with me about, you know, and shy away from votes that you've taken. And I agree that you haven't done that, but you talk a lot about intellectual honesty, which is something I value. I think my viewers and my listeners value it. And when I look at the ban on assault weapons, and the idea that it's going to reduce violence in our communities, I see a failure of intellectual honesty in the Democratic Party because shootings with assault weapons account for such a minute fraction of the shootings and the homicides in this state. And then I see Democrats, hands off, On the other gun violence that's happening with handguns or whatever it is on the streets. I mean, we just had a pregnant woman shot with a stolen pistol in downtown Seattle. So sure, you know, if you want to ban assault weapons, my question is, what are you doing to actually combat the driving factors behind gun violence in our communities? Because that ain't it.
Well, I think, to me, the big change we need to make is we got to break this silo way of thinking. Like, my frustration in 21 was the state budget was flush with money. We had one-time federal COVID money. We're a sales tax state. So when we had inflation, we had way more sales tax receipts coming into our state coffers. Cities and counties were begging for help on the public safety front, saying, this is the issue that we're struggling to solve. We need support when it comes to public safety. And Olympia is stuck in this siloed mentality saying, oh, no, that's state and local problems. They have to figure out how to find money to solve that problem. And to me, there's got to be a pause button on starting these new unknown programs. We have no idea if they're going to work when we're not, as a state, getting a core function of government right, which is public safety. And if that means the state has to do a better job of sharing revenues with cities and counties on public safety, that's what we should start doing. And I use marijuana taxation as the poster child of this. When I got elected in 2012, we didn't have a single penny of marijuana revenue. And the idea for marijuana revenue is we're going to share it with cities and counties to help with public safety. Now we get $500 million a year of marijuana revenue. We share $40 million every 2 years with cities and counties. It's a drop in the bucket. So if we can have a better way of thinking about public safety, of saying the state has to be a better partner with cities and counties to make sure they have the resources to get this done right, then I think I agree with you that, you know, that assault weapons ban, if that's all you do, you're not making Washington State safer. We have to do that and be a better partner with cities and counties to make sure they can hire the police officers, get them trained, get them out in the communities, and actually make people who commit crimes have consequences for who commit those crimes.
Well, because Bob Ferguson, that assault weapon ban is his child. It's his baby. He's been pushing for it for years. He finally got it in the year that he's running for governor, where he's the heir apparent for the job. And he's going to sing the praises of that from the rooftops. And I find it difficult for you to then take the position of, oh, well, that's not going to solve our public safety challenges when you voted for it. I mean, I would have liked to see an intellectually honest moderate Democrat say, hey, guys, I know this is something a lot of people care about, but it's not actually going to, it's just a headline grabber. It's not actually going to solve the bulk of the crime and homicides that we're seeing on our streets. And you didn't do that at the time. So how do you do that now when Bob's running around like, oh, I passed the assault weapons ban?
But this is the clear difference between Bob and I, right? Yes, he talks about the assault weapons ban. The two big public safety issues this last session was the police pursuit bill and whether or not we decriminalize drugs like the state of Oregon did. And there was a large push to, one, decriminalize drugs like Oregon, which all you have to do is go to Portland and realize that's a horrible experiment, has not worked out. And the fact that I have to argue with my colleagues around whether police should be able to chase after criminals and drive away from them was something I never thought would happen in my 11 years in the Senate. Bob didn't lift a single finger on either one of those issues. So here's the main public safety issues facing our state. He did not lift a finger on either of them. I was the one in there fighting that fight to make sure we actually had consequences for public drug use, which we got a gross misdemeanor. I was very happy with where the final bill landed. I agree with you on the police pursuit bill. I wish it was stronger, but I also agree with you. It's still incremental progress. It's better than if we had done nothing like we did in the 22 session. And that's the big difference between Bob and I. He didn't lift a finger on the two most important public safety issues facing our state this last session.
Well, also be aware, I'm not your campaign consultant, but I already picture at some point in the campaign, Bob Ferguson's going to talk about his retail theft task force that he started a year and a half after he said not jack shit about the looting in downtown Seattle. So I want you to be prepared for that. Be like, hey, Bob, where were you when downtown stores were being looted to the studs? Because you didn't say anything. Free tip for you, by the way. $55.99. It has pissed me off to no end, to be frank. And you supported it. And I remember us sitting here and I was baffled by the support. And you basically told me you feel bad for trans kids. And that's why you supported it. Is that a good enough reason to strip parents of the right to know where their kids are sleeping at night?
I think, and you're 100% correct. If there's a population group, being on the Senate Education Committee for the last 11 years, I think it's transgender youth who, as I've seen them in front of that committee, who I probably the most sympathetic towards because they've just had a pretty tough life experience up to that point. But I think on that bill, and I understand people's frustration. I have six kids, my wife and I think, you know, we don't want the government telling us how to parent our kids. So I think that's an important thing to get out there out of the gate. I think the reality was the shelters felt when they notified the parents, this is where they are, that the kids were then leaving before the parents got there. And now they were on the streets. And then the challenge was nobody still knows where they are, except now they're in an even less safe environment than they were before. I think the general premise was let the parents know that they're safe, but they don't know where they are. But the premise was when they were told where they are, the kids were then just leaving the shelter because their whole goal was to avoid going back to that household. And it's a tough issue. I understand people's anxiety around the issue, but I wouldn't change my vote on that bill. And I know this is a place where we're not going to agree, and I respect that. And I think that's been my life in Olympia, right? You can't put me in a box. And so I think when bills come up for a vote in Olympia, like, I try to listen to both sides of the argument, and I try to decide which one I think is the one I'm going to support. And I, to me, Senator Lee has made a pretty strong argument on his bill, and so I supported it.
I've had three Democrats in here now to talk about their yes vote on 5599, Senator John Lovick, Senator Joe Wynn, who was a co-sponsor, and yourself. And the common thread for each of you when I listen to your explanation is I don't feel like either of you are able to explain the bill succinctly or the purpose of the bill succinctly. And that tells me that it's not a bill that's even necessary. Do you feel like you fully grasp the necessity of that bill?
Well, I think what we talked about last time I was on your show was it'll be interesting as you go forward in the next year to see how many times this actually comes up. Because I think if we actually track the data, this isn't something that's happening in thousands of cases. I think we're in the tens, not the thousands. And so it'll be really interesting to see as you move forward. But and I think the question is, this is tough public policy questions, right? If it only ends up helping 30 or 40 transgender youth like stay in a shelter longer as opposed to going on the streets to avoid, you know, having to go back to their home, is that a positive benefit for all the, I guess, anxiety it may have caused for people feeling like the government was interfering in how they parent their kids? And that's the discussion we'll have to have going forward.
Now, let me give you an opportunity. In the other room, I have a copy of Referendum 101 that would send this bill to voters, for parents and voters in Washington State to decide. Do you want to sign it?
I'm not going to sign the bill. I appreciate the offer.
He's like,
but
that would have been the death knell of my campaign.
I will sign the bill to repeal the long-term care payroll tax.
Yeah.
Like, if you give me that one, I'll sign it.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to find all my friends I can to sign that one.
Then let me ask you this, and we won't go back and rewrite history, but if you're the governor starting in 2025, my fear with 5599 is the slippery slope. We have some policies happening in Oregon and California, and as you know, those sort of, well, the West Coast just shares ideas, right? There was a bill introduced in California that would say, let's say that you were in a custody dispute, not that your happy family would ever break up, but, and you disagreed with your child's stated gender ideology, that could be used as a reason not to give you primary custody of your kid. In Oregon, foster parents have been denied adoption opportunities because they wouldn't express on paper that they would get a foster kid gender reassignment surgery if they wanted down the road. So I'm worried about what 5599 could lead to. If Mark Mullett is the governor, do you promise to be cognizant about the erosion, about bills that are further eroding parental rights in our state?
I think parental rights are really important. Like I say, we, you know, Penelope, our youngest child, is going into eighth grade. Our oldest daughter is starting her junior year up at Western. We have six kids. Like, I'm not down there to involve the government in how parents raise their children. I mean, I want to give the flexibility to parents to make those decisions. I think going forward, my positive, I think, character trait in Olympia last 11 years is I take the time to listen to both sides of the issue. I think a lot of elected officials don't. Like, they get told one side and they're like, oh, that other side is evil, I'm not going to listen to them. Like, I'm a pro-choice Democrat. I have met with pro-life groups every year that I've been in office. And I know we're not going to end up agreeing on that, but I still feel like I owe them that, as I represent them in the Senate, and it's my obligation to actually have them come into my office and share what their views are on these issues. And I've done that every year. And I would do that as governor. Like, I would always make sure that people have access to tell both sides of the story, even if I might go into that with a bias one way or the other. a lot of times when I hear both sides of a story, I do end up changing my position, and it's different than how it was when I started.
Yeah. You mentioned long-term payroll tax. Went into effect July 1st. Stupidest thing I've ever heard of. I mean, I had in Senator Curtis King, and we had a good long chat about it. And just for you, I mean, what is the route out of that? And what route are you willing to pursue out of the long-term payroll tax as it's currently constructed?
I wish it would just be canceled and start over. So obviously, like I said, I'm not signing your 5599 repeal, but if you had the initiative, which I think there's ones out there, I don't know what's going on with them, but the initiative to repeal long-term payroll tax, to me, is the quickest way to do it, is to have the public weigh in and send it to legislature for a vote. So it's actually the people get a chance to weigh in on that next year. If that ends up not happening, I think I use my role as governor to say, hey, there's a lot smarter ways to solve this problem. Like, we just have to break the cycle of trying to solve every problem facing our state by creating a new tax. And to me, streamlining, making it easier for low-income workers to save for retirement makes 10 times more sense than creating a new tax. And at the end of the day, if our goal is to make sure that low-wage earners have access, you know, to long-term care when they get older, it makes a lot more sense to focus on helping them save for retirement. There's new federal programs starting in 2027 that will actually draw down federal money for low-income workers who are actually setting up retirement accounts. And so you can actually take a program and utilize new federal support that'll be there. And that, to me, that's portable. Like, they can like half of Washington residents will retire out of state because our climate's not the best climate for retirement, I think, a lot of people's perspective. And at least in that case, it's portable. It can go with them. It's not a tax. It's their money. The government never has to touch it. But we're helping people get set up for a better retirement, just not creating a brand new tax.
Yeah. Are there any other, there's a couple things I want to close with, but any other big issues that you want to discuss?
I mean, I think this affordability issue, to me, is the chair of the capital budget. So that's our state construction budget. I don't think there's anyone more pissed off how hard it is to get a building permit in our state than I am. And so I've seen where we fund a building. It's a $40 million building. All of a sudden, there's a two-year permit delay. And literally, it becomes a $50 million building. And so when we look at the cost of housing, like, to me, this idea that rent control is how you make housing more affordable is completely divorced from reality. Because you pass a rent control bill, all the private capital we need to attract to our state to build housing will go to a different state. So we're not going to get more housing. We'll get less housing. But to me, if we can streamline that permitting process of say, hey, it's going to be more predictable, easier to navigate, and it's going to be shorter, that's how you attract private capital. If you knock off $30,000 or $40,000 in the cost of building a unit by making that process work better, well, that's like $300 a month in rent. You know, for the staff who work in my pizza restaurant ice cream stores, like, if you could lower rent by $300 a month, that's really meaningful. And so to me, this affordability issue is, how do you make it more affordable to build in our state? How do you get rid of things like the long-term care payroll tax? Because that's not helping. How do you actually fight climate change in a way that's affordable? There's so many different issues affordability is touching right now. And when they stack on top of each other, it's why my wife and I have anxiety. Their own six kids won't be able to afford to stay and live here when they get out of school.
Is housing a solution to homelessness?
I think you definitely need more housing. I mean, pure and simple, we need more units. And, you know, to build more units, you have to make it attractive for capital to come into our state. Like, as the chair of the capital budget, we did $750 million in affordable housing. That alone is great, but you have to also make sure you're creating a path for the private market to build more housing in our state. You can't, we don't have the capacity with state dollars to build our way out of this problem. We have to view the private markets as our partner in adding more housing units.
Let me ask it this way. Is housing the solution to homelessness?
Well, in the sense, if you have more housing, do you have less homelessness? I mean, I think you will if you have more housing units. I think the more you can slow the rate of housing inflation, I think the less homeless people you will have. In terms of a short-term solution of the people who are currently homeless, I've kind of chosen the tiny homes approach of saying the best bang for your buck is to have that prefabricated housing that you can do in a very affordable manner. Like, I think it'd be very intriguing for the state to buy like 5 or 10,000 tiny homes and say any jurisdiction that's willing to keep their public right of way safe for families so people aren't, you know, occupying it, you have access to these tiny homes. You just have to actually keep your end of the deal, which is to make sure, you know, our sidewalks and parks are safe and free for folks to use.
And I'm sorry, it wasn't a trick question. It's just because I get annoyed when Governor Jay Inslee says, oh, let's spend $4 billion on housing and we'll fix the homeless crisis, when I believe it's a drug crisis and a mental health crisis. I mean, how much of the homelessness crisis do you believe is a result of somebody really can't afford a place to live versus they're drug addicted or mentally ill?
I think it's both. I think, yes, but this goes back to my frustration of we're not getting a core function of government right. Like, we have to hit the pause button on these new sexy programs that we're not sure if they're going to work when we're not actually providing the mental health treatment that a lot of Washington residents need. And so to me, this is the change in leadership that I think we need in the governor's office, which is saying, hey, we're going to get core functions of government right. That means public safety. And I think public safety, your point, means you have access to mental health, you have access to substance abuse treatment, and we're going to actually prioritize and partner with our cities and counties with state money to make sure those services are available. But it comes with accountability, right? This is why I supported the final version of, you know, the Blake Fix bill around public drug use. Is, yeah, it's a treatment-focused bill, but if you're going to willfully leave treatment and refuse it, yeah, you can end up in jail. And so, yeah, our first approach is make sure people get treatment. But if they choose to leave treatment, they're not just getting handed a brochure. There's consequences. And to me, that was worth going to a special session for, was to make sure we got a bill that actually had accountability. And I think it's important.
Dave Ryker doesn't change your calculation moving forward. Obviously, the field is rapidly adjusting. For you, who is the voter that you think you most need to target from now until the primary? Who are you aiming at?
I think it's voters who care about making Washington State more affordable and voters who want to see a state on the West Coast get public safety right. I mean, California and Oregon are not getting it right. Like, let's have Washington be the state that sets an example on the West Coast of how you can get public safety right. You can be a business-friendly state. Like, my wife is a second-grade teacher. Like, I know there's a symbiotic relationship between a successful business community and a good K-12 public school system. And to me, the voters who want to see that change, like, I am giving them that choice. This doesn't have to be a Bob Ferguson coronation. There's a choice in this race, and that's why I'm in here, and I'm really excited to be running.
Are you going to return your Ben & Jerry's locations to Native Americans?